Welcome, welcome, Pastor Smith. We're so glad you've accepted the call to First Church.
Why, thank you. And I'm so glad to be here.
Mm-hmm. Now, if you'll just hold these, please.
Wow, that's heavy. What is all this yeah, stuff?
Well, these are our expectations for what you'll be doing 24/7 in terms of the ministry, evangelism, discipleship, teaching, counseling, yeah, visitation, sermon prep, board meetings, janitorial, and other duties.
No, wait! I can't do all this by myself. I've got a family.
Family? Family.
Yeah.
Family,
I just moved here.
Well, whatever that is, Pastor, you'll have to take care of that on your own time.
I'm not gonna have any.
Oh, no. Well, do you ever feel like all the duties and expectations of church are leaving you with no time for your family? If so, we hope to help on this edition of Pastor to Pastor. I'm Chris Fabry and our host, Reverend H.B. London, Jr.
You know, Chris, that is a common complaint that we hear from a lot of pastors, especially from their spouses and family members. The kids are wondering where their dad is, the spouses are wondering who it is they really married. And the problem, of course, is that it can be pretty hard sometimes to draw appropriate boundaries between the various jobs and roles of a pastor and the stuff he or she needs to take care of at home.
Yeah. I know the answer to this question, but do a lot of pastors feel like they're just on call every day, 24 hours a day?
You know, I think so, especially in a smaller church, where there's little or no staff. But you know, Chris, there's another phenomena that I see happening, and it's among the younger pastors. And a lot of the younger pastors, they just refuse to get caught in this web. But the question is, who else is going to do the work? That's what really we have to answer. Or certainly in those situations where a church is growing and the pastor feels tremendous pressure to oversee this and that and the other. And then some pastors, like myself, I hate to admit, we're just built that way. We're type A personalities with some kind of drive. I don't know if it's God-given or self-imposed, but to help serve people, to be available whenever they're needed, you know, to kind of be a super person when maybe that's not who you're meant to be. Unfortunately, as I've confessed many times before, and this seems to be confession time, pastors like me can also become workaholics to the point that the church becomes all-consuming. And as one pastor's wife said to me one time, the church has become my husband's mistress. Yeah. And that's not good. And even if we do carve out time to be with our families, so often we're really not there. And they keep saying, you're not listening. You didn't hear a thing I said. The kids want your attention, but you're somewhere else. And, you know, once we hear that 3 or 4 or 5 times, not only do we get the picture, we get frustrated because we don't know how to handle it.
Yeah. Well, on this edition of Pastor to Pastor, we really hope we can give you some practical and encouraging words for how to find that right balance between ministry and family life. Our first guests are authors and conference speakers, Dr. Greg Smalley and his wife, Erin. Greg is the son of well-known author Gary Smalley. Greg and Erin work together at the Center for Relationship Enrichment at John Brown University in Siloam Springs, Arkansas. In addition to writing and speaking, the Smalleys do intensive relationship coaching for both married and engaged couples.
You know, Greg and Erin, I think you've been married, I don't know, 16 or 17 years, whatever that might be. But I remember way back when I pastored in California that Gary Smalley and John Trent brought their dog and pony show to our church to our church in Pasadena, and the place was jammed with 3,000 people, and we had just a wonderful full weekend. And so that was about the time I got to know your dad, probably 20, 25 years ago. And then having been to Branson so many times and done the pastor's event with your dad at the chateau and at the palace and all those places, you know, and having listened to the stories of you all growing up and getting married and the trips you've taken, it's kind of like I'm a part of the family.
You are.
Just kind of looking in.
Yeah, absolutely. You've been a good friend to our family. And, you know, when my dad and John, when they did or at least when my dad came to do the dog and pony show, Which was I? Was I the dog or the pony? So I'm never quite sure. You were I'd rather be the dog.
But you were well represented with stories, I'll tell you that.
Yeah. That's true. Yeah. I was the strong-willed child of our family, and so I actually inherited the spanking stick that my dad made us sadistically color.
And put holes and beat it up a little bit.
I know, but I got that, and so now my kids will inherit that as well.
Well, you know, and so because of your background, and Aaron, I can't blame you for all this. I can just blame Greg, basically. But, you know, because of your family background and, you know, the family that you've had and the influences you've had and all the schools you've gone to and the books you've written about this and that, I just would imagine that you have the perfect marriage and the perfect kids and the perfect relationship. And that's the reason why I've got you on Pastor to Pastor, because we need something perfect.
Yeah, that's exactly. So the word's out. That's great, because someone is really misspoke about us big time.
Yeah, they obviously aren't living next door to us.
Aaron, when you were going with Greg and you guys were getting ready to get married and everything, and you had that Smalley mystique around you, did that ever give you pause at all?
Do you know, the funny thing is that I really, honestly, wasn't really aware of who the Smalleys were. They, and that's hilarious, but I was raised in a different faith, and it really didn't, they weren't real predominant within that faith. And so when I got to know Greg and his sister Carrie, I was best friends with his sister in college, I just really got to know the family and fell in love with the family. And I really, honestly can say I really didn't know the full extent of what I was getting into, but God had already prepared me for that, and I didn't even know it.
See, in my life, I've got the Dobson mystique hanging over me, and people are always saying, what's it like to be Jim Dobson's cousin? And I always say to them, why don't you ask him what it's like to be my cousin?
Yeah,
that's right.
That we were actually just going to ask you that, so you know, you beat us to that punch. Yeah, yeah. The funny part is that I can't tell you how many times that people usually call me Gary. So, I mean, Greg, Gary, I mean, it's close. But usually I'm Gary. And then oftentimes they'll see Aaron and think that she's my dad's wife. And they'll be like, wow, now how different an age are you guys? And it's really quite creepy in many ways. But you know, we actually, you know, when I remember telling Aaron when we were getting married, I said, hey, this is going to be a piece of cake. I mean, I'm getting my doctorate in marriage and family, you know, grew up in this great marriage and family with the experts. And it took us, just a few weeks to realize that this is not going to be easy, to the point to where our first 2 years, we really struggled. I thought that we were one more argument away from Aaron leaving me. Man. I didn't think she divorced me. I just didn't think she wanted to be around me anymore, because it was hard for us.
We had a real hard time handling conflict. And looking back, we can say that those early years, although they were so challenging, it really led us to where we are today. We really had to grow up and learn how to communicate and learn how to work through those hard times. And everybody, I love to tell people that, yes, we, in fact, have very difficult times too, but we work through them differently than we used to. And it for them, I think often the light bulb goes on to say, wow, if you guys have hard times, then it's okay for us to have hard times too.
Well, you know, I know you've got three children. So when did the first child come along? How long had you been married before the first child came?
Well, the first child came along a little sooner than what we had expected. We had been married 1 year and 1 month when we got pregnant. On our second anniversary, we had a 1-month-old baby girl.
So definitely. We don't talk to people about birth control. So
and ironically, I'm a labor and delivery nurse. You would think I would have had that figured out. Yeah. But God obviously knew what was better for us, because really she was really influenced us to really take that step toward growing up and toward really working on our marriage and getting in sync and just becoming great teammates.
So in a sense, having the children was not only a positive thing for the world, so to speak, but I mean, it really did cause you to look more completely at your marriage and how to handle conflict and how to get along with each other as well.
Absolutely, because you can just sort of, well, not that you can just skate by, but when you bring a child into the relationship, I mean, they say the research is the moment you bring a child in, the average couple has 8 times as many arguments than before kids. And so, I mean, it brings in a reality. Either we're going to learn how to handle differences and work through problems, or we're going to be a statistic. And, you know, and Aaron and I, we love each other, and we hope that we can help people learn how to have great marriages. But you know what's really cool, though, HB, is that that probably since even we turned our bio in, we've just found out that we're going to have number four.
Oh, congratulations.
In a very unique way.
In a very unique way?
We have just, well, for the last year, we have been pursuing a little girl in China, and we just found out last Tuesday that officially we are matched officially with her, and we will get to bring her home in 4 to 6 months.
Yep.
Number four.
Annie is her name.
Have you had to make the trips over to China and do all those kind of things, too?
Not yet. So we've been over to China before, but we can't wait to go pick her up.
Well, you know, really, what we're trying to do on this edition of Pastor to Pastor is explore the challenges of balancing ministry with the family. And, you know, sometimes I say to pastors, if you're talking about balance, that may not be the best word, because I'm not sure there is a real balance. If you're talking about managing, then that's something else. And in my life with Beverly and our kids growing up, I didn't balance things very well, but I tried to manage them as best I could. And so if I could just kind of get you to kind of work with me on this, when I say to you, what are some of the proactive ways in which you've been able to get some really clear boundaries between the demands of ministry and your family life, what would that be? Now, let me set this up. You know, you guys have, you go on speaking events, you write books, you got three kids, you're at a big university, you've got all the family things going. So when I say demands of ministry, it probably is demands of ministry, right?
Absolutely.
Yes, yeah, definitely.
Yeah, God has blessed us with some wonderful opportunities. I think one of our friends, David Ferguson, who's a pastor, probably had a huge influence on us understanding this. And I think the biggest thing that we learned about balancing ministry and marriage was that, you know, for a lot of people, that really sets up a myth. And the myth is somehow that we, kind of like you were saying, HP, that you can balance somehow these two things. Almost like that marriage and family and ministry are two separate things, kind of like two plates that you're spinning around, you know, on the end of the stick. And anytime one starts to wobble, you attend to that, and then all of a sudden the other one will start to wobble, and then you put your efforts and energies into making sure that that's still spinning. And I think for us, what we've learned is that, you know, I think the reality is it's not about balancing. It's about realizing that marriage and family and our ministry are like two concentric circles. You know, they're not separate, and they're not isolated, they're not siloed. But there's something that, if they're more concentric, they overlap with you know, kind of God's right there in the middle.
Sure.
And what that's done for us, it's really helped set us up to go, you know, our family and ministry should never be separate. And I think the biggest thing that we've done is try to figure out, so how do I include my wife? How does she include me in our ministry? How do we include our kids? And, for example, years ago, I made a decision, you know what, when someone invites me in to speak, I'm going to bring one of my kids along.
Huh.
And we've had some amazing times. One time I was on an airplane taking my daughter, Maddie. She was probably three at the time.
Wow.
Or four. I mean, she was young. But, I mean, you know, I took her with me. In mid-flight, she stands up, faces the rest of the plane, and yells out, you know, screams, "Hi!" You know, scares all these people, and says, "Hi, my name's Maddie," and she pointed at me, and "This is my daddy," and I'm thinking, oh, here we go. And she yells out, and he spanks me.
Oh, man.
right in this crowded plane. Of course, everybody's looking at me like I'm some abuser, and what do you do in those moments? Yeah. But those are the times, though, that our kids now point to the times that they've come and traveled with Dad. And, I mean, I've taken them everywhere.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
And that's really come out of that notion that these aren't separate and distinct, that these are, they're concentric, they're so overlapping. And so we constantly look for ways to include our entire family. Wouldn't you say, Erin?
Absolutely. And I have just recently begun traveling with Greg over the last couple of years, and I can attest that there is nothing more enriching to our own relationship when we can stand up and teach others through, as an overflow of our marriage,
sure,
to share what we are learning in our own marriage. We never stand up and say that we have it perfect, because when we tell our stories and tell our experiences, it's very obvious that we are on the journey of growing a healthy marriage too. And there's nothing more enriching than sharing in that ministry together. And our kids understand that it's good for mom and dad to do this together.
And so if I can follow that reasoning along, then so that when you come home from a speaking trip or when you just come home from school or whatever, it's not a matter of turning off ministry and just being dad. But when you include them all along the way, you're always dad. Does that make sense?
Absolutely, because we include them in discussions about opportunities. We talk, they come to university here at John Brown University and come in at times and sit in my office. And, we really, as much as we can, we try to include them. So, yeah, so there's not like this time to where we have to turn on or one and turn off the other. And I think what's fun, too, like with our son, Garrison, who's now 8, I love to hear him say, hey, can you show me which office is going to be mine someday? And he's already talking about, I was asking him the other day, he either wants to be a football player, a Navy SEAL, or a marriage speaker. And they're all very similar.
Where do you get that last one from, I wonder?
Exactly.
Yeah, of course he thinks daddy should be playing professional football with
him. Well, because, when you look at me, it's very easy to assume that I am a professional football player. So.
Hey, well, one of the things, too, then, I always had a problem with workaholism, because I don't think that I included my kids as well as you all have suggested that I should have and that you do. But it would seem then that family would be one of the greatest defenses against workaholism because they keep reminding you of your responsibility and your place in their lives and the need they have for you. I had a hard time getting that together because the only model I had was a workaholic father. And so my thought to be successful in ministry was just to put all the work ahead of everything else. And our family suffered because of that. But what you're saying to me really makes sense. If you include the family, they're not going to let you be a workaholic.
Yeah, I think that when we think about workaholism or even, the boundaries like we've been talking about, another element, too, that's been so great is just the greatest commandment. We really try to model our ministry around the greatest commandment, saying that the top priority is to love God. If that's the greatest commandment, is to love the Lord your God with all your heart, soul, mind, and strength. That's first and foremost what's most important to us. But then you also then to love others as you love yourself. So another big component that we really try to do in terms of workaholism is we have to learn how to take good care of ourselves so that we're constantly being re-energized and recharged. And so, so what does that look like? But then I think the others part is that when you think about others, it really, my wife is the number one spot in terms of others.
Uh-huh.
My relationship with Aaron is more important than any other relationship. Again, God's number one, and then it's my wife, and then it's my kids, and then, it's extended family, and then, fellow believers, and then unbelievers. So, we actually try to prioritize. There's a sequence of priority in relationships.
The season of life that we're in right now with our kids, I have had to prioritize heavily on my children and cut out some extracurricular stuff for myself simply because we're in a season of having teenagers and, I'm in the car a lot, driving, and so my priority is with them, but my first priority is to Greg. So it's our marriage and then our kids. So sometimes when you are prioritizing these in that order that Greg was talking about with the others, that other things have to be set aside for this season. And it's just for a season, and we realize that.
And, I think the other thing that helps us as well is when we think about workaholism, we also think about the word busyness. And in many ways, those two are very related because, whether you're in ministry or not, in our culture, we are so busy. We lack margin. And what's so sad is that, there are so many verses in the Bible that talks about his desire for us is that we have abundance. And he wants, Ephesians 3, where it talks about that you may be filled to the measure of all the fullness of God, sure. That he came to give us life so that we may have it, abundantly, to the full. And yet the evil one wants to kill, steal, and destroy. And we know that he attacks us through busyness, whether it's investing in overly investing in work or just whatever. And one of our favorite things that we've learned in China is the character for busyness is made up of two things.
It's made up of two different symbols, and one is killing, and the second one is heart.
Wow.
So essentially, busyness means dead heart in Chinese. And that's exactly what busyness does. It ends up taking our heart out of the game, and when our heart's out of the game, what do we have left? Where is love? Where is the peace? I mean, so much is taken out if our heart's taken out, and that's what the evil one wants to do. I actually learned recently that oppressed means to wear out or wear down, and that's what happens when we are so busy without margin, like Greg was talking about, that we end up being very oppressed and very worn out, and our hearts are dead.
Yeah, I mean, you know, it's like busyness or workaholism. I mean, that makes us look important, but literally cripples our relationships. It, you know, it's like it feeds our egos, but it ultimately is going to starve our souls. It fills our calendars, but fractures our families. And there was this quote that says, "And busyness props our images, but shrinks our hearts." And I think that that's what we try to remember, is that the cost of all this, of being a workaholic or busyness, is that it shuts it down our hearts.
Well, let me ask you this question. We're talking primarily to pastors and their spouses and their families. Let me give you a hypothetical situation.
Yeah.
A pastor comes to you, and, you know, I think all of us try to be sensitive to our own children and how the ministry is affecting them and the influence. And the pastor says, you know, I see an aloofness in my children. They don't really want to go to church as much. They're kind of solitary. They're reclusive. They sit by themselves in the back of the church. In fact, the other day, one of my kids say, "Dad, if you weren't here, I wouldn't even go to this church because the people in it are not nice to you, and they're not nice to Mom, and I don't like them." What do you say to a teenager, a 13, 14, 15-year-old kid who's really down on the church because evidently the church has taken a really big bite out of their existence, so to speak?
Well, again, I think that's why what we've tried to do is approach this, that let's not separate church and family, and as much as we can try to cultivate our kids being involved. So, I mean, when there's still opportunity with this teenager to do that, but understanding that if that's how the teenager is feeling, I can tell you, HB, when I said almost those exact words to my dad when I was a teenager.
No kidding.
And I loved what my parents did. And I just came to it and said, you know what, I hate this church. I don't get anything out of it. All my friends are going to this other spot. and it was where my dad was at. And what I love that he did is that I think the language he would use now, because this is basically what he did, he said, you know what, if this feels like a loss for you, he would have said, then this is a loss for our family, and that's not okay. And what could we figure out that would feel good to you and to me? What could be a win-win for both of us? And the win for him was me being in church. The win for me was finding somewhere that I really felt more comfortable, and maybe we're around some friends that I knew or whatever. And what we did is we ended up finding another spot that my parents let me go to, and that lasted for a season, and it was great. And what it did is it made me feel important. It made me feel like that this wasn't just about making everybody at the church or making us look good so everybody thinks we're the perfect family. I mean, they gave me freedom to go find somewhere that I was able to invest, and I'm telling you what, I've never forgotten that. And that's when you approach your family is this, you know what, if one of us is losing, then the whole family loses, and that's not okay. So let's figure out a solution that you feel good about and I feel good about. Why can't we do that? And that's what they did for me, and it kept me from, I think, turning my back on church. So that's what at least we'd encourage a pastor to do.
You know, and I've heard you all teach on this whole concept of loss before, and it really does make sense, but it takes honesty, doesn't it? I mean, the child has to admit that this might be a loss in his life. And as a parent, I can't just say, oh, no, it's not, or that's not true. I've got to agree when we've got to agree what loss is. Is that right?
Well, and we have really nurtured that with our kids. When they come to us with their feelings and their emotion, we really try to validate what they're feeling. We don't have to agree with it. We don't have to feel the same way, but simply just saying, wow, I'm really hearing that you feel that this is not a good situation for you. You feel unimportant. You feel criticized, and just validating that. And it's building that relationship that is safe, that they feel like they're going to be heard, they're going to be validated, that mom and dad are on our team. That we may not always agree, and we may, and there's situations where there's consequences, and but ultimately that they feel like they can come and be heard.
Yeah, that, I mean, that's really, we're trying to make our home feel like the safest place on earth. And we want them to feel safe. I love that. In the name of the Lord is a strong tower, and those who run to it, and they feel safe. And that's what we want our kids to feel, and that's why helping them to feel safe means that they know that their feelings matter to us,
yeah.
That we're not going to run over them, that their ideas and their opinions and their beliefs and their questions are important to us. And therefore, we're going to take the time to care and to listen, to understand. We don't do this perfectly. I mean, geez, just last night, you know, my middle daughter, Maddie, was getting ready for bed. She wasn't moving fast enough, and man, I barked at her and shut her down. She went into her room crying, and then I was yelling, "You're crying too loud. I can't concentrate. You know, be more quiet. Shut your door." I mean, pathetic. And yet, I ultimately went in there and said, "You know what, man, I was wrong. Tell me, what was that like for you?" And it was hard to hear how I made her feel and what her experience was like. But, you know, I could own that and take responsibility. So, I mean, I have to deal with this stuff all the time.
Those of us who have grown up in ministry families, you know, I'm sure we sit down and we talk about the horror stories of being in the fishbowl where everybody's looking in and they're privy to the, you know, our dad uses his illustrations just like you did with Maddie and all those kind of things.
Exactly. And then they make up ones that never happen.
Yeah, then they make them
exactly.
up.
Exactly.
And you mentioned a while ago a safe place. And I would think that both you, Greg and Aaron, would agree that that safe place has got to be the home, right?
Absolutely. And, you know, we have a lot of fun in our house, even laughing later on, "Hey, do you remember last Sunday night, Dad, how you lost it with me and this is what happened?" And we nurture that fun environment. And so really, I think our kids really ultimately enjoy hearing these stories. They tell stories, and it does breed just that shared sense of safety within the family.
Yeah, you know, one of the things that my dad and mom and I have had this conversation, that they did so much, so perfect for me growing up. But I tell you, there was one thing that I told them that I wish could have been different, and it was that when we were out in public, my dad constantly would remind us that people are looking at you, they're watching you, you better be on your best behavior. Not in a way to try to control us so much as just he wanted to say, you know, people are going to look at you and you need to be aware of that. It really put a lot of pressure on myself and my siblings, and we felt like we couldn't be authentic and we couldn't be real. And Aaron and I have talked a lot about that, to where we've never said that to our kids. And we don't want them to have that pressure of knowing that people are looking, because it's reality. They're going to look. You know, we want them to be authentic. There are times it's so painful when my kids are arguing and they're bickering and they're, you know, Garrison will go up and smack his sister, you know, punch her on the arm or something.
Yeah. Or having our one daughter who cried every single day going into kindergarten for almost the entire year.
Yes.
And our entire town would see it and they would say, "Wow, today was really a good one."
Yeah. And so, you know, and so what we've tried to do with our kids is just, you know, we let them be who they are, and we, you know, they're responsible for how they treat each other. But we've never tried to set up, hey, we're sort of in this fishbowl. And yet the other thing that we do, too, is that we surround ourselves with people that we can really trust.
Good point.
And so we've got some great friends that feel very safe, that we know they're not going to be out sharing what we talk about and you know, and gossiping about us. And that's who we can really let our hair down with. And, of course, my hair's short anyway. But, you know, we can really loosen up with them and just have fun. And so I think that's important, that in ministry that we've got people who are safe, who that we can just be real and authentic with. And we try to, you know, help our kids to know that, you know, you're going to make mistakes. But we don't want that added pressure of, oh, yeah, but everybody's watching you. So at least that's kind of how we've tried to do things.
Our guests on this edition, Greg and Aaron Smalley, thanks for the insight. Thanks for the advice. I think, you know, the word loss comes to me. Safe place comes to me. Letting your children be who they are and letting them develop naturally. And you all have done such a wonderful thing through your conferences and your books and your tapes and SmalleyMarriage.com and all these kind of things. And thank you for allowing us the time just to kind of look in on your family and laugh a little bit.
Well, we are so appreciative. We're humbled to be on with you. You've done such an amazing service for pastors, and we're just excited to share whatever has helped us with pastors. So thank you so much.
Absolutely.
Thank you.
You're listening to Pastor with Reverend H.B. London, Jr. I'm Chris Fabry, and it's been our privilege to have Dr. Greg Smalley and his wife, Erin, join us on the program. If you want to know more about the Smalleys, we encourage you to visit that website. Again, it's SmalleyMarriage.com. That's S-M-A-L-L-E-Y, marriage.com. H.B., I liked what Greg and Erin shared about including their kids as much as possible in their ministry, which I'm sure helps minimize the sense of tug of war between family and ministry expectations.
You know, I like that too, Chris. A lot of pastoral families will tell you they spend a lot of time at the church and whenever there's a family activity, like a church picnic or potluck or whatever. But I also encourage families to get away whenever they can to just be together doing something they enjoy apart from the church. You know, a time and a place where they can just be normal family like everybody else. But the thing that I found as I've talked to a lot of pastors along the way, Chris, is that even if it does deal with church, if the members of the family can take ownership in what's going on at the church, if they can show an interest in what their mom and dad are doing, if they can somehow buy into the fact that this is who their moms and dads are and they've been called to do this, there's not that resentment or anger or kind of a I hate the church mentality that a lot of pastors' kids develop.
Yeah, exactly. Well, we have a lot more encouragement for pastoral families coming up. Our host, Reverend H.B. London Jr., convened a special panel of couples to describe how they've worked out the juggling act of family versus ministry. That's coming up in our second segment of Pastor to Pastor.